Welcome back to Posting Through It. I'm your host, Jared Holt. Joining me this week is Chris Mathias, a dear friend and a senior reporter for HuffPost. Chris, how's it going?
Hey, it's great. Thanks for having me, Jared.
I mean, how could you not be in a great mood after spending a few days of your life once again at CPAC, the annual gathering of conservative activists? It's been historically a place where reporters go, flock in from all over the country, even internationally, to get a sense of the heartbeat of, you know, whatever the modern conservative movement is at any given moment. But I heard this year was pretty boring. What was up with CPAC this year, Chris?
Oh, great question, Jared. I think this is like my fourth CPAC, and what was most noticeable was that it was less crowded. There were much fewer events. So usually at CPAC, there's like the main stage, the main ballroom. It happens usually at the Gaylord Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. And usually there's like the main stage where, you know, you have your senators and congressmen and presidential hopefuls speak. And then there's usually these like side like breakout sessions where, there'll be separate panels and stuff. But there are like barely any panels this year. The only panel that I went to outside the main stage was five people who had been arrested on January 6th, who talked about their experiences and kind of cast themselves as, being persecuted politically. It's hard to decipher exactly why CPAC was a little quieter this year. I think the prevailing theory is that, maybe you've talked about this on the podcast before, but a month or two ago, there was a story about the organizer of CPAC, Matt Schlapp, who's the head of the American Conservative Union, who was credibly accused of sexually assaulting a male staffer in Georgia, who he was giving a ride to. Obviously, it's interesting because CPAC, the event Matt Schlapp organizes, has been a haven for homophobia and just kind of anti-LGBTQ bigotry in general. So I wonder if that took some of the wind out of the sails of CPAC this year. Matt Schlapp, usually he's a very big presence at the conference. I think he was really only on stage the first day of the conference, and he also didn't really mingle around the conference at all and didn't really provide reporters any opportunities to ask him about how he allegedly grabbed a staffer's dick in a car.
So it was also on kind of a back heel, too. I was talking to somebody over the weekend who used to work for CPAC in one way or the other. We'll call them a former employee.
Yeah.
Who said that, in the recent years, a lot of the staff that run CPAC have grown really frustrated with, the Schlapps and just the organization in general, and have left. So, in addition to all of these theories, there's also, I think, a pretty real question about staffing. Folks that had been around for a long time that had, high competencies and promotion and organizing and whatever, a good chunk of them may have just gone out the door a year or two ago. And it may very much be reeling from that. There's certainly a lot of problems with CPAC in general.
Yeah. I think there's also, you could maybe make the argument too that, during the Trump era, CPAC was essentially a 4-day Trump rally every year. Mm-hmm. And now with, potentially maybe some growing divisions in the GOP over Trump, that could, also be playing a part. But I think, like you said, the staffing was a big issue. It was an absolute nightmare to get a press credential for this year's CPAC. Did not end up getting it until the evening before the conference started, which is really unusual, which I think kind of points to the staffing problems you're talking about.
Yeah, I was trying to help a buddy, get in touch with somebody to get a press credential. And as far as I know, they just got radio silence. But you said that there weren't a whole lot of panels happening on the side of CPAC, which is pretty unusual to not have that. That usually you would have the main plenary session kick off something like 8 a.m., someone like Mike Huckabee would come say a prayer that God blesses Donald Trump, and then, you know, you're off to the races with Diamond and Silk, RIP Diamond, you know, and, yeah, and all the hottest, you know, conservative commentators and activists, which are all there to tell you why the libs are bad and they are good, question mark. So it's interesting to me, it was just confined to that main stage, because I feel like that puts the photos that I saw of that main room being so empty into even a more, you know, if I was the organizer of CPAC, concerning focus, because it's not like these people really had much where else to go, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. For when Sebastian Gorka opened ceremonies on Friday, I think that ballroom was maybe a quarter full, which was really striking to see. And also, I just remembered, I think there's two other reasons. Maybe it was kind of poorly attended this year, which was that they lost Fox as a sponsor. Fox was usually all over CPAC. They have booths. Last year, Fox Nation was there with, you know, a lot of promotional material. And then I think the other thing is that there was a lot less young people there. And I think that was because TPUSA was not there this year. And I'm not entirely sure what the story is there, but I think that's another reason why that ballroom kind of looked so empty. To be fair, there were, you know, later in the day after Gorka spoke, and I think during some more popular speakers, it was more full, but still.
So of the things that did happen at CPAC, well, I mean, first off, it's just very weird to think about for me, at least. I think I've been to 3 or 4 CPACs. They all blur together, honestly, man. You know, it's very weird for me to think about it in sort of like has-been context. I guess we'll see what the future holds. But out of what was there this year, you know, for what prevailing themes there could be, one that you wrote about specifically was the transphobia that's been on display. And that's been a hot commodity among conservative media figures, you know, everyone from Tucker Carlson to the former president to libs of TikTok and so on. It's like the hot meal ticket right now in the griftosphere. And which would be, you know, whatever if it wasn't so dangerous and, you know, threatening to trans people and also just the LGBT community, you know, more broadly. But how did that play out at CPAC?
Yeah, man. And I think it's important to stress, like, when we start talking about this, like, you know, as diminished as CPAC was in many ways, I think it's still an extremely important conference. And it's where I think the GOP is kind of fine-tuning its messaging for the presidential campaign next year. And if this conference was any indication, the GOP is going all in on anti-trans rhetoric. It was incredibly disturbing. So I got there on Friday morning, and like I said, Gorka was among the first speakers, and he, you know, as part of his speech, you know, talked about Democrats wanting to mutilate boys and girls and sacrifice them on the altar of transgender insanity. And then of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene was a featured speaker, a little later that day. It's crazy to think about that I, you know, was at the convention hall in Florida last year where she gave a speech at a white supremacist conference. And here she is a year later, kind of the standard bearer of the GOP. And so on the stage at CPAC, she did maybe like a 5-minute speech solely devoted to anti-trans stuff. And she basically announced that she will be reintroducing a bill, which I believe is called the Protect Children's Innocence Act, which would make it a felony to perform gender-affirming care on minors. So that was basically, I kind of wrote in my piece, like I think the lead is that, like, you know, thousands of conservatives, including like lawmakers and presidential hopefuls, like, came to this convention to discuss children's genitals for 4 days.
Yeah. I think I remember that being the lead.
Yeah. And It's literally like all anyone wanted to talk about. Obviously, this like campaign against trans kids, as we're seeing it play out in bills across the country and stuff, you know, Green kind of assured the crowd that she'll be able to do this at a national level now that McCarthy is Speaker of the House. But then the most like shocking part of the conference, which everyone's talking about now, was Michael Knowles. Is that how you say it, Jared? Is it Knowles?
It's just Michael Knowles. And I know the clip that you're talking about, so I'm just going to play it real quick.
There can be no middle way in dealing with transgenderism. It is all or nothing. If transgenderism is true, if men really can become women, then it's true for everybody of all ages. If transgenderism is false, as it is, if men really can't become women, as they cannot, then it's false for everybody, too. And if it's false, then we should not indulge it, especially since that indulgence requires taking away the rights and customs of so many people. If it is false, then for the good of society, and especially for the good of the poor people who have fallen prey to this confusion, transgenderism must be eradicated from public life entirely. The whole preposterous ideology at every level.
Yeah, so he said this, and then I think what gets me about that, well, first off, a lot of news publications covered this comment, rightfully so, because, you know, my take anyways, that's a pretty fucking terrifying thing to say out loud on a stage like CPAC. But then they sort of had the audacity to, you know, claim that all this coverage is incorrect. They weren't calling for the eradication of trans people, just trans ideology, whatever that means. I guess what I worry about, and because I don't see what Noel said in a vacuum, is just this escalating rhetoric. I worry about how much this keeps cranking up. Frankly, how the big brain centrist writers who have, you know, huge audiences, certainly bigger audiences than like you do or that I do or whatever Antifa super soldiers do. but they keep ratcheting this up. And I feel like this is just like yet another escalation. And, you know, maybe Michael is throwing a fit and saying, you know, I didn't call to eradicate all trans people. But who knows? Like maybe this time in 2 years, someone like Michael will feel comfortable saying that. I don't think it's like a huge secret what these folks are after, which is to just eliminate the presence of trans people from public life. And, you know, if you think, you know, that sort of thing stops with one minority group, you just got to take a spin through history. And
Very well put, Jared. And I think like I have to be a little careful how I talk about this. But what I will say is that a lot of people have interpreted his comments as eradicating trans people. I think they're making the argument that if you're calling for eradicating transgenderism, you're calling for eradicating trans people. Knowles is claiming that's not the case. But I will say, regardless, his speech was incredibly disturbing. And also to be in that room and to hear a crowd go wild for those comments was also very disturbing. And also when you kind of break down the whole speech, you know, what he was essentially saying is that trans people do not exist and they should not exist. And he's also saying that, you know, sure, the GOP is going after gender affirming care right now for minors, but he was suggesting that that's kind of a pathetic half measure and that Republicans need to go all out. I think he said that there's no middle ground when it comes to transgenderism. So I think this was a really good demonstration. And like you said, it's a really good example of how this rhetoric escalates. And what, you know, trans people, trans activists, trans writers have been saying all along is that, you know, it's going to keep escalating. It's always been about eradicating trans people from public life. It started off with trans people in sports. Now it's on to gender affirming care for minors. And then now we have someone at CPAC calling for the eradication of transgenderism from public life altogether. So I think that was rightly the big news from CPAC. And I think it's also important to, you know, he was not an outlier there. You know, everyone I talked to there was, it was the first thing that they brought up. I talked to an old guy who had recently left the Episcopal Church over its support of trans youth. And I talked to another guy who had just ripped his two daughters out of public school because he said it was too woke, because it, you know, acknowledged the existence of trans people. So, yeah, his comments weren't really out of place at CPAC this weekend. Noel's comments.
It's really unfortunate. You know, they say it's not about getting rid of trans people, but if you're trying to take away their care and trying to, you know, boot them out of living a normal life, to me anyway, it's hard to, you know, not see where that goes. But I want to sort of move on to, I was going to talk about the Groypers, but honestly, Groypers, if you're listening, that was pathetic. Pathetic showing at CPAC. Not impressed. Very boring. You're losing your moxie, guys. Just Nick is a bad leader. Don't just move on. Okay.
I will say it's interesting that they managed to get a room at a Marriott hotel for their rally outside across the street from CPAC.
Yeah.
But I agree, they're not worth talking about.
Yeah. Okay. What I did want to talk about was a story you wrote about this woman who was, you know, a very prominent propagandist for a space online that many people like myself who work in research and many reporters through the years have referred to as Terrorgram. And for people who have no idea what I meant when I just said Terrorgram, you mind giving it a shot explaining what we're about to talk about here?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's awful.
Bad stuff.
Terrorgram is it's an ecosystem on Telegram of accelerationist neo-Nazis who believe in and are very explicit about their desire to carry out acts of violence, especially racial violence, and to destroy public infrastructure, basically just to throw the world into chaos so that they can kind of create their white-only world in its place. There's a lot of accounts on Terrorgram, and, you know, it's just been kind of one of the most extreme places online, I don't know, maybe since like 2019. Is that when you would say, Jared?
Yeah, that's when I think it first started getting on people's radar. You know, a lot of the people that make content in that network of accelerationists, the type of people producing, you know, literature or videos or whatever it may be, hoping to inspire the next, you know, terrorist or mass shooter or whatever it may be in this pursuit of, you know, collapsing society and building, you know, Nazi regime 2.0 out of its ashes, a lot of them have been anonymous. You know, accounts get banned, they disappear, that sort of thing. But last week, Left Coast Right Watch dropped a dox of one of them, and you followed that up with some additional reporting, you know, hopping on the phone, trying to call around, get some more information. Tell me about this person and what they were doing. They had screen names like Pretty Dictator, the Lolita of the far right, Lil Lolita, Hopeless Fangirl, Lil Miss Gorehound. And the Gorehound one is, you know, kind of what she was primarily known as in the Terrorgram network. But tell me about this person.
Miss Gorehound has been a prominent propagandist in the kind of Terrorgram ecosystem. And we kind of figured out that she was also a part of a network called the Terrorgram Collective, which was producing some of the most popular propaganda on Terrorgram and kind of in this world. And what they would do is they would turn mass shooters' manifestos into audiobooks. They would make these kind of PDFs of neo-Nazi propaganda, encouraging people to carry out mass shootings and to attack power grids, and they made a video called White Terror last year, which glorified and documented chronologically 105 like white supremacist terrorists. And what this network does is they're very into canonizing mass shooters. So, for example, the guy who killed 51 Muslims at two mosques in New Zealand, Brenton Tarrant, is referred to as Saint Tarrant. Dylan Roof is referred to as Saint Roof. So they refer to all these people that committed these acts of terror as saints. And the point of their propaganda is that they are trying to encourage other people to become saints. They're trying to encourage other people to carry out mass shootings.
Yeah, they entice them, with this, because oftentimes these networks prey on people who are, for lack of better words, I'll say broken people. People that could, really use some help or really use a network around them, and essentially make them this promise that if they feel their life has no meaning, this will give their life meaning, and they'll live forever as a canon, as you said, canonized, or almost like made into a deity for this like very, very, very intense ideological network. So this person's real name, something tells me after reading this article, you've got it and you might have a decent idea of who this person is.
Yes. So her name is Dallas Humber. She is a 33-year-old woman living in Sacramento. It's a little unclear what she does for a living now, but in the past, she, sells art and she has worked as a tutor. And then kind of the more salacious detail is that she was a dildo saleswoman. There's like a video of her promoting dildos. You know, what the anti-fascist researchers who unmasked her found is that she has essentially been mixed up in this world since she was a teenager, since she was like 13. And there's some evidence indicating, and I've also heard from some people that know her since the story published, but that she has... might come from a family. She was kind of born into this world. Mm. But at around 13 or 14, she starts popping up on different message boards and live journal on a site called DeviantArt, where she's posting really disturbing cartoons. She's an artist. She's obsessed with anime. At one point she posts a cartoon she drew of Joseph Mengele, the Angel of Death at Auschwitz, and it's like a nice drawing of him, and it's like anime style, and she wishes him a happy birthday. And then she is also fond of like drawing a cartoon of a blonde woman with blue eyes who is probably a version of herself, dressed up like the Christchurch shooter, the guy that killed 51 Muslims in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then she also, something that she's really into, she, since a young age, is really into writing letters to serial killers. And one of the letters that I talk about in my piece is a letter she wrote to Dylan Roof, who, of course, was the white supremacist who killed 9 people at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, back in 2015, and who's in a federal prison in Indiana. But Dallas Humber posted letters that she was sending back and forth to Dylan Roof. And she posted a letter that she claimed was from him, requesting that she draw him some art. And he requested that she draw him a wizard. She draws him a wizard and apparently puts this in the mail and sends it back to him. But somewhere along the way, and kind of the most important part about Dallas and why we decided to write about her is that she's the narrator for Terrorgram. So for all of its like big propaganda pieces, its videos, its audiobooks, she is the voice of Terrorgram. She's narrating it. She narrates mass shooters' manifestos. She does the narration for the video celebrating mass murderers. And I think for a lot of people, it was a bit jarring to hear a woman's voice and kind of like this deadpan American accent talk about this stuff, especially because it's such a male-dominated space. And, people I've talked to have said that, it's not uncommon for white supremacists to use women in their movements to be their main propagandists, because you know, it's their belief that it might be more accessible, successful in recruiting people. But yeah, so she lent her voice to some of the worst neo-Nazi shit I've ever heard. And worst of all is we know that it's had a real world impact. Back in October, a 19-year-old man opened fire outside a gay bar in Bratislava, Slovakia. And in his, quote manifesto, he thanked the Terrorgram Collective for all the propaganda that they had produced for kind of inspiring him. And of course, Dallas Humber was part of this Terrorgram Collective.
So something I appreciated about your piece was you kind of got to the question of whether federal law enforcement or any law enforcement, frankly, was aware of this person. And I think it's a totally fair question to ask, especially if the evidence seems to indicate that she has been, you know, may have been born into, you know, the movement, if, you know, if it were, or that she has had an affinity for this kind of stuff for so long in the, you know, Terrorgram network, which I have, you know, very little doubt is probably under very close scrutiny from federal law enforcement these days.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's kind of a fair question on, like, does law enforcement know about this person? Did they know about this person? And if not, why not? Or if they did, what gives? Were you able to pull any sort of, you know, indications on which way that line breaks?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I agree with you that, you know, Terrorgram's very, there's a lot of feds looking at it. And I reached out to the FBI and to the Sacramento Police Department and to the local sheriff's office. They mostly declined to comment. The sheriff's office, you know, said that they were unaware of Dallas, but that, you know, they forwarded the information to their gang suppression unit, which, like, investigates bias crimes. But I don't know if that means that they will monitor her or not. But something I talk about in the piece, which I thought was maybe instructive, which was this is the second time that HuffPost, again, working from the research by anti-fascist researchers, helped unmask someone on Terrorgram. Back in 2020, a guy who went by Vic Mackey on Terrorgram was unmasked as a 27-year-old pizza delivery driver named Andrew Cassere. But what we learned recently is that there was that leaked no-fly list, right, that someone got from 2019, mm-hmm. and his name was on it, which means that federal law enforcement was aware of him before he was publicly ID'd by anti-fascists and by HuffPost.
So they knew who he was before the rest of the world caught on.
Exactly.
And then there's the question again of, so what gives? They just kind of kicked their feet up and said, don't fly, but otherwise have fun?
I mean, it's, I guess the argument that they would make is that, you know, it's investigative secrecy. Like, they are aware of this guy, but they don't want him necessarily to know that they're aware so that they can monitor him and see what he's planning and who he's influencing, who he's talking to. I think it's, you know, that raises some serious questions, though, because, you know, this guy was encouraging people like Dallas to commit acts of mass murder. It's tough to know. I mean, they could be doing the same thing with Humber, and if they didn't know about her, they definitely know about her now.
So what value does doxing somebody like this have? You know, there's a lot of different terms about doxing. You know, HuffPost didn't publish any addresses or anything, right? But I think, you know, this is like a form of doxing. Like, if we're honest about that term, it's revealing, you know, somebody who, you know, revealing information that somebody's trying to have private and making it public. You are writing a book about doxing. So I do imagine you probably see some value in this kind of stuff. So give me the sales pitch, the elevator pitch. Why should people pay attention to these kind of doxes, and why should people care?
Yeah. Thanks for the plug. I'm working on a book that's tentatively titled To Catch a Fascist that will tell a lot of stories like this. I think the value of doxing like this is that it creates a social consequence for engaging in this type of extremism or fascism. You know, a lot of the work that, you know, I've done at HuffPost, and I know a lot of the work that you've done, Jared, is to expose people in positions of power who hold these detestable views. And it's, you know, I've written about Nazi cops, Nazi soldiers, Nazi teachers, Nazi politicians, and the public has a right to know if these people in positions of power hold beliefs that are, you know, hateful or genocidal. It's also, you know, it is at the end of the day, it's an act of, and I think this is, you know, kind of pre-internet anti-racist action. You know, they used to put up the meet your local Nazi posters where they would identify local Nazis and put posters on telephone poles to warn the neighborhood. And I see doxing as kind of the digital equivalent of that. If there is a Nazi living next door to me, I want to know about it because they are a danger to me and to people I love and to people in my community. And so that's why I think that's where the value in this type of doxing comes from.
I couldn't have put it better myself. I've been talking here with Chris Mathias, senior reporter at HuffPost, also a good friend. It was good to see you the other day.
It was great.
Chris, you've been on the show before. It has been a while, though. So do you remember what the last question I have for you is?
Oh, no. I just remember that I really fucked it up last time. What is it again? It's something about a meme.
What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Ooh, okay. All right. This is really random and nerdy.
let's hear it.
I follow all of these Instagram accounts for border collies, which are dogs. And I can't believe I'm telling this. It's basically just, videos of them like, shepherding, sheep, and how amazing they are and like how they listen to voice commands. And there's like this whole network of border collie Instagram accounts. I should say I had a border collie growing up. This is why I'm interested in it. But that's kind of my latest thing at the moment.
Border collies on Instagram. check it out. Oh man. I don't know if I have a favorite thing on the internet right now. I've spent like the last half week like very not online. My favorite thing on the internet right now is just marveling at like how bad Elon Musk is just continuing to fuck up Twitter. Yeah. And it's like it's also the kicker for me is that it's all so preventable. It was running okay, not great, okay. And then he showed up and fired everyone. And now it's like, whoa, why is it breaking? Yeah, dude, I wonder why.
It is so janky right now.
Very janky. Anyway, with that, Chris Mathias, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Jared. Great talking to you. Hold
it. Okay, just start again. Real fast. Nazi punks, fuck off, take three. Fucking no religious, though. From listening for yourself. And hardcore, we got your hair with a jock suit.